Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori Davis. You're listening to The Lori Davis Show here on Blog Talk Radio. And today, a very tender topic, suicide. And I've invited some friends to join me so that they can share their stories. And we all know that we're not alone. We're just not alone. Welcome to our panel. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here. And those of us left behind, wow. The struggle, the pain, the grief, whew. So each of my guests has their own particular story, and I'm just going to turn the mics over to them as they appear. So listen in on how my panel was able to get past it all and move forward. We don't ever get over it. We don't ever forget it. But we're still here, and we need to move on. So my first guest, Dr. Sharon Stroud from hot Desert Springs, California. I believe she's on the line. So I'm just going to just get right into it here and turn the mic over. And thank you all for listening today, especially this time of the year when this really has a lot of meaning for some of us, because these tragedies can happen at pivotal times of the year, which makes those pivotal times of the year even more painful. All right. Well, first guest is here. Welcome, Dr. Sharon.
So, dear Lori, it's a joy to be with you today and to really acknowledge this topic, which so many of us have really been through. And I am speaking from Desert Hot Springs, California. And my story is about what happened with my sister. And my sister had, you know, it's really fascinating about the polar opposites, because my sister had alcohol and she had some drug issues. And I was always the one that went to court to speak in her behalf and have her released in my custody, and she'd be fine for a while and in a 12-step program, and then revert back to her very, very self-loathing and very low self-image. And, you know, we can only support a person at the level that they're willing to be supported. We cannot do it for them. It's very important that we really get that, because so many people said, oh, if I would only have done this, if I'd only have done that, if I'd only... No, each person is living their destiny and it is unfolding. And my sister and mother were broken into in Las Vegas, Nevada. And it's amazing that they really lived through it, because when my mother went to go to the phone to call the police, he kicked her in the pelvis and broke her pelvis in four places. He stabbed and raped my sister, and she said she grabbed the scissors and she, you know, stopped him in his tracks at that moment. And they were both in the hospital recuperating. My sister had her upper femur. It was broken. So they were recovering in Las Vegas, and then went to St. George, Utah, because a friend said that the hospitalization is much better there. So decided, they made a decision, they were going to go to Petaluma, California. They were going to start a new life. And so they got in. Here's two women on walkers, if you can imagine, 6 months from, you know, broken bones, and getting in their car in a U-Haul. And someone said, go to the Caliente Mountains, and what you will find there is you will save 2 hours on your trip. And so they went to, you know, 60 miles up to these Caliente Mountains. And this was a Labor Day weekend, which is really one of the hottest days of the year. Excuse me. Minnie, come here. And what happened, they broke down. They had a flat tire. And so they did not know how to change the flat tire to the U-Haul. And so out of that, I'm getting many. I'm so sorry. You'll have to apologize.
That's okay. That's okay.
Come on. They were there for 8 days and 8 nights without food or water. And on the third day, my sister said, Mom, let's just take our own lives. We are never going to get out of this. This is going to be a terrible, terrible death. And out of that, my mother said, absolutely not. You know, I want to see Sharon again. We were estranged because of the alcoholism.
And on the third day, my sister, you know, she kept starting the engine because they didn't want the battery to go dead. That was the excuse. But on the third day, my sister went back. She tented the back of the car and inhaled carbon monoxide. And so when my mother awakened the next day, now they're up in the Caliente Mountains, 60 miles up. I mean, they did things like put SOS on top of the car because they had a white planes, went over every day, didn't see them. They started a brush fire. It went out. I said if it was arsons, it would still be burning, but it was two women in distress, and it went out. And my sister was, you know, getting water from a mile down from a little stream. But on the third day, she tented the back of the car with the, you know, engine on and took her own life, committed suicide. So when my mother awakens at 5 in the morning, she goes, Jan, and no answer. And she sees this outrageous display of, you know, I mean, it was just, it was unbelievable that my sister was dead and they were in the middle of nowhere. And there is my mother with her daughter's dead body.
Oh.
And for 5 days, my mother was there with my sister's dead body. She said animals, snakes and things start coming out because the body was decomposing and there was an odor.
Mm-hmm.
It was attracting
mm-hmm.
animals. So she wrapped my sister in a rug that they had in the U-Haul and was drinking her own urine because no food or water.
Mm-hmm.
And on the eighth day, she had an appearance of an angel. And she said, she was really, really angry, and she said, you won't take your living, which was her, or your dead, which is my sister. And yeah, and she just said, she sort of ranted on, mad at God. The angel of the presence said, you will be rescued tomorrow, and it will not be the Rangers. So two guys in their 20s go 60 miles up to hunt so that the Rangers will not catch them hunting. But what they did not know is that they had a divine appointment, and that divine appointment was with my mother. And when they found this scene, you can just imagine these guys on seeing the scene was outrageous. And the
wow.
one young man had the presence of mind to say, I am a religious man. And what I know is I am the saint, you are the witness, and your daughter is the angel that led us to you to rescue you. So they wrapped her up. They gave her little tiny drops of water because you cannot give anyone any amount of substantial water if they've been without water for any length of time. So when I received the call from the social worker that your mother and sister were in an accident, your sister died, you know, she didn't say, and I'm going, you know, what's going on here? I had to repeat it three times. So I flew to St. George, Utah, and met with my mother. My best friend went with me. We went into her room, and she had third-degree burns just sitting in the car, you know, during that 8 days and 8 nights. And I just said, I am just so, so sorry. And there were nurses in attendance. And, you know, she, when I got off the plane, she
mm-hmm.
was on the front pages of the Daily Spectrum newspaper there in St. George, Utah. So it said, mother survives tragic incident in the desert, daughter dies. You know, it's all on the front
mm-hmm.
pages. And we just did kind of like this surrounding her with this amazing energy and embracing each other, the nurses, the attendant, my best friend, myself, just, you know, really
mm-hmm.
crying about it because it was so outrageous. And went home, and my mother, you know, came to live with me. And I was in my office, which was off, it wasn't attached to the house, it was like a cottage on my property. And I was in my reclining chair, and I was kind of in that twilight stage, and my sister appeared to me. And she said, oh, Sharon, I'm so sorry for everything. But now I understand in my light body. And in our way of life, in metaphysics, we believe that you leave one plane and you move on to the next. And, of course, you know, those feelings, the separation, physical separation, number one, is just really untenable at times. And there was just like this bright light and these words, and then she vanished as quickly as she appeared. And I really got it. And in our way of life, we do not judge anyone's decision to leave the planet or how they leave the planet or what their destiny is or what their divine contract is. But we know that those who go don't always feel the pain and parting. It is they who stay behind that suffer, that and then need to heal and, you know, move through their own emotions and all of the what a, you know, what a, coulda, shouldas, and all the things that people do when they lose a loved one in that way, because it's so abrupt. It's so abrupt, and we're not prepared for this kind of departure. So it's suicide is a whole different deal than someone like my husband was ill for several years with cancer and passed, and it's never expected, but it's not the blow, that quickening and that energy of immediate separation and severance. And mm-hmm. I counseled many, many people in my congregation. I am a minister of Interfaith Spiritual Center worldwide, and that have had children commit suicide, which is, to me, the mm-hmm. most devastating thing that can ever happen to a person. And that whole energy of, you know, why? Well, we discover why is a butterfly loose in the universe. We're never going to know the whys of another person's spiritual contract or their destiny that they are fulfilling, and that they came to this certain point and chose to move on. And it's not up to us to judge, but it is up to us to have compassion, understanding, and not judge ourselves or them for their decision to leave the planet. And we, you know, we go through all of our changes and our whole grief process. I mean, it's first is absolute just disbelief, and, you know, and then going into the anger, and then the, you know, acceptance, and finally the healing part of it. So, you know, this is a bizarre story. I mean, you don't ever think that you're going to see your mother and sister in the headlines of a newspaper. And my mother did not tell them that she committed suicide. She said that she just woke up and her daughter had died. And in my mother's upbringing, that if anyone committed suicide, their soul was in danger of hellfire. And so she really didn't even let me know for a while that it was that way. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff took me aside and said there were no snake bites. There was nothing to indicate, you know, so we just put she died of exposure on her death certificate, because my mother didn't mm-hmm. want suicide on her death certificate. So it was mm-hmm. It was a lot to go through in my mother's recovery. And you can imagine, you're in the hospital, you've got third degree burns, and your daughter's dead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to be with that dead body for 5 days, you know, to me, it just, that took a tremendous amount of strength.
Absolutely.
So for me, you know, being a minister, and you know, I've counseled so many people, but when it happens to you, it hits the quick. And then, you know, the whole energy of looking at life and that we're meant to be here. And yet we have to have compassion and understanding for those that choose not to be, without judgment and without self-recrimination and, mm-hmm. and judging ourselves. So for all those that have suffered this incredible experience, I would say to them, you know, forgiveness is, you know, forgiveness and compassion, and especially self-forgiveness if we're recriminating, oh, if I'd only done this and only done that. And every soul has its spiritual unfoldment and their mm-hmm. own destiny to fulfill. And it's so difficult to come from that Buddhist place of non-attachment. We care deeply. However, that place of non-attachment is understanding. It's compassion. It's allowing. It's allowing that soul to evolve, even if it's not here. As my sister said, I understand everything in my light body. To mm-hmm. me, that was just the revelatory thing I could ever have heard. And
wow.
And I had her ashes sitting on my altar. And this next Sunday, you know, it was Easter. So my mother and I and some dear friends, we went and took her ashes to the ocean and, you know, said some prayers. And just the energy of being in her light body was very comforting to me and to my
wow.
mother.
That so. Is an amazing story and experience. Not a story, it really happened. So I just want to thank you so very much, Dr. Sharon, for coming on and sharing your story. And I know my listeners will glean from that and appreciate all of that. So our next guest is here, so I'm just going to put you on mute and you can do what you like. And I will welcome our next guest. And thank you so much. Love to you.
You're so welcome, dear.
Okay, bye-bye. Our next guest is, her name is Lisa. And Lisa has a totally different story to share. And all of the stories are special and unique. And when I say story, I'm not referring to something that's been made up. These are real life stories. So I would like to take a moment now and welcome Lisa to the mic. And she's going to share her experience. Hi, Lisa. How are you today?
Hi. Good, Lori. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Well, I'm really grateful that you could come in and share with us what happened to you. And this was after we had met. So over to you, Lisa.
Yes, thank you. So my name's Lisa. I live in Saskatoon, and I work in the corporate world in the agricultural area. And my story is about the father of my son. I was married to him, of course, and his mental health, I knew nothing about mental health. I think a lot of us didn't know a lot about mental health until like we are finally knowing a little bit, and it's openly talked about a lot more now, which is so helpful for everyone. But so my husband's mental health just slowly deteriorated from 2000 to 2010, and I didn't know how to help him. I didn't know what to do. He only wanted to deal with the physical side effects of it, and so we were dealing with a lot of manic episodes. And my son was born in 2003, and that was a real bright spot, and things got better for a while. And he was a really good dad. But by 2010, I just didn't feel we were safe. So I moved my son and I out of our family home. And the next 6 years were quite rocky, with a lot of anger, manic episodes, just trying to deal with Tyler, not wanting to take Tyler, my son's dad, away from him, but recognizing that I wasn't comfortable at all with what Tyler was experiencing when he was with his dad. And then he took his life. And my son was 13. And so I, as far as what feelings I had and what feelings Tyler had, it was a total shock. For Tyler, it was, you feel all the feelings and nothing at the same time. Mm-hmm. So sadness, anger, grief, relief, guilt because of the feeling of relief. But the biggest thing was the loss of hope for the future, the loss of hope that something could get better, that Tyler could get his dad back, that, you know, that loss of hope was probably the biggest thing. And also I had to deal with the fact that I was the ex-wife. So why did I have any feelings about this at all? Like, get over it. So that was fun. And then just trying to find support for Tyler. It took a while for it to really hit home, I guess is the way to put it, because how does it hit home for anyone who's of any age, let alone if you're 13? He had nightmares every night for about 4 months. And, you know, you try to decide what the best thing is, and there is no one thing. That's, looking back, that's being open to anything. So it was multiple modalities, really foundational on self-worth, because looking back on my son's dad's life, fundamentally, he really just didn't understand his own worth, and really needed to feel like his dad was proud of him and that he was accomplishing things and that people recognize it. And it all had to come externally. Once I learned more about self-worth and where that comes from within, it was foundational for what path he ended up on. And so then we better make sure ours is solid and foundational. So both Tyler and I did work and continue to work on our self-worth and knowing that we have value and in who we are. And knowing that I had to do things to heal the brain, heart, and spirit. And Tyler was just open to whatever appointments I made for him. So simultaneously, while he was doing weekly sessions for his self-worth, he met with a social worker. He's met with a psychiatrist. He did body talk. And it takes many different things to heal the brain, heart, and spirit. And just knowing that the people that you're dealing with are reputable, that it's safe, and that there's a connection. For a 13-year-old, when I tried to get him to a therapist or psychologist, it seemed like if it's a kid, they just get whoever. And so I interviewed counselors and psychologists. I didn't realize what a wide range the word counselor is. And I wanted somebody who understood PTSD and had was reputable, and we did find that. And so that was really meaningful. And it's very interesting because, of course, it's been 4 years. And so I asked my son about all the different things he did. And, you know, this the whole time being open to whatever would connect. And the self-worth was key. You know, he's not sure about anything else, but it did heal his brain and his heart. But he felt he didn't, this one's hard, he didn't have a soul and that he'd lost that. And he actually, we're not go to a Catholic school, and the learnings he had through those classes through grade 9 to 12 reaffirmed that part of him.
Oh, nice.
So it was really powerful, and there's just so many broken pieces that just to be open. So whatever comes that helps pick up one of those pieces.
Right. Well, in your situation, it wasn't just you. You had a child, basically, to deal with on top of yourself. So good job. And, of course, I know the family intimately, so I'm really proud to know that he's better. And I was looking at your Christmas card today and that beautiful million-dollar smile and on Tyler, and I think I've said this to you before, the money you spent on his teeth were well worth it as well. All right, Lisa, thank you so much. I'm just going to mute you, and we'll welcome our next guest. And ladies, thank you so much. I'm sure our listeners, if they're not listening in right now, they'll join us. We had over 8,000 people see the post on this show today. So this is a very timely and hot topic for us to be discussing today. So just want to put a big shout out to all of my friends and connections who shared the post. Thank you so very much. Bye for now, Lisa. My next guest, the gentleman, Nathan. Give me a moment to welcome Nathan. And Nathan has his own special story, a little different than everybody else's, of course. So welcome to the show, Nathan.
Well, thank you, Lori.
So the mic is yours. Just introduce yourself and where you're from and your story, and over to you.
Okay, my name's Nathan. I'm from Lloydminster. I work as a plumber, and back in April of 2018, I was going through, I had a whole bunch of things just all hit at once. So I just ended a relationship that was on and off and was just mentally very trying on me. And I had my parents, my brother and sister, about a month before that relationship ended, decide that they were in the process of going to shun me and not talk to me, same as the church for religious reasons. And then I had a coworker who was asking me just to keep quiet. You know, we don't want to hear what's going on in your life. You don't really matter. Like, just keep work stuff at work, personal stuff at home. Then I had an ex-wife. You know, I love her to bits now, but at the time, she's wanted to go to court on things that we've already dealt with. And that, when I hit all that stuff all at once, it's like, so what's next? You know, like, what's next? I just had that feeling of being just overwhelmed, lost, abandonment, you know, that's the part about being lied to, knowing that your parents don't want to talk to you anymore, only if you do what they have to say. And, you know, at age 41, I was like, what the heck? This is all wrong. You know, like, let me just do what I want to do. Let me be myself. And then people telling me stuff and just not be able to trust them. You know, thinking that your parents and your family is going to be with you all the time. And that trust was just like ripped right out from underneath me. That's how mm-hmm. I felt at the time. And, you know, I never forget when I was talking to, like, after the event happened, the doctor, he goes to me and he says, what you've been through is like more than anybody's been through in their entire lifetime. You know, so I had a lot of stuff going on. A lot of it was abandonment stuff. And, you know, I never forget that day, April 9th, 2018. I was just done. I was done with everything. I just like, you know what? I'm just ready to be at peace. And so I said my goodbyes on the phone. And then I couldn't handle it anymore. I didn't have the nerve to, you know, just jump off and like wrap a rope around my neck and just feel that pain. So I ended up drinking to, you know, get that courage, liquid courage to finish it off. And somehow when I was talking to my uncle on the phone, they located to where I was at. And I was just sitting there drunk, and I got spooked by the cops, and I ended up jumping off the bridge. And as I jumped, the police officer grabbed my foot, and I was hanging upside down from the bridge. And I just went there and I kept pounding his fist to let go, and he wouldn't, thank God. This is just let me die. And I never forget that all of a sudden, wham, they tasered me, I let go, and then they dragged me. But I never forget the moment of actually, like, leaping off the bridge thinking I had it made. And then, boom, somebody just taking me right back into the world saying, we're not done with you yet. You know, and I'm so grateful for that. Somebody went there and fought through the pain of me punching their hand.
Mm-hmm.
100%, you know, because the smiles that I've seen ever since then and the smiles I've added to people's lives, how it's changed it for the better or for the worse, it doesn't matter, you know, and mm-hmm. mine has been, it's been huge. But, you know, one thing I've come to realize is I was put in the mental hospital for like 3 days legally that I had to go. but I didn't do it. They didn't do a thing there for me. I didn't, no medication. They offered, I'm like, I don't really want to take it if I don't need it. They're like, well, okay. But the work began once I started doing the work, but the health board had nothing to offer because it's a broken system, you know, and people know it. And like, there's so amazing many souls out there that love us and want to help, but their hands are tied with what the resources we have. I was fortunate enough to like know you to start doing the work on self-worth, you know, because that's when really I got to understand like what I was worth, you know, sitting around with a bunch of guys to understanding why I was doing these behaviors, you know, and to understand that I was doing the best I could with the information I had.
Right.
And the information I had was all broken at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And the best thing you ever did, Lori, was just sitting down, getting me to answer the questions, not telling me the answers, you know. And the moment it clicked, that was everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so grateful. You know, like, it was just a minute in time. Like, if anybody, you know, like, it will get better, but it only gets better when we decide it's going to get better. You know, have I had crappy moments since? Heck yeah. But that's just a moment. You know, like, there's 24 hours in a day. It's just a moment in time. You wake up, it's a new day, life changes. Sometimes it takes a while, but it's worth it. But to know that I have a second chance at life is a game changer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that a lot of times after people have tried to take their own life, then there's the shame that's wrapped around that even that they have to deal with, right?
Well, that's it. Like, I remember for about a year, it was like, how you doing? Are you okay? Yeah, actually I am. I finally told the world that like, I was broken and I ripped the mask off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's half the battle right there is I found that I had this mask on saying I was fine, you know, because I believed it, but I wasn't. I was just a hurt boy.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you know, getting to that point of breaking down and saying, no, I'm getting some stuff figured out was probably the best thing that ever happened. Like, I'm not recommending that avenue, but, like, deal with your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you won't have that chance, you know?
Right. Well, I know your three children will be mighty grateful for that, and now your journey since then has been nothing but moving forward. And so your story, I believe, is one of great hope for anybody out there right now who's struggling with those thoughts of taking their own life. So I just want to thank you so very much for coming in and sharing that very personal side of you, Nathan. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome very much. You know, you're one of the reasons why I'm here. I'd do anything, you know, thanks very much. Lauren.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I'm just going to put you on mute because our next guest is here. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope the show is helping you to feel that at the very least, you're not alone. You're not alone. There are many, many of us out there who have had to deal with this situation. Welcome, Nazen.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate it. Over to you, Nazen. The mic is yours.
Thank you. So my name is Nazen de Gagne. I am in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And for a living, I actually graduated at the age of 21 taking my youth care worker diploma. And I've been in my field about 16 years now. My title right now is Youth Justice Mentor and Youth Outreach. So I'm working pretty well a lot with our inner youth core and kids that are struggling and going through the worst of the worst. So for myself, I was 8 years old when I learned that the world wasn't really that perfect. I was bullied a lot. I was called down. I was told I was fat and ugly. I'd never amount to anything. It was pretty bad at school. I was able to beat up all the boys except two, so now I instilled fear in everybody. And I will never forget it. I remember sitting at the supper table with my family, and we were having my most favorite meal, which is my dad's spaghetti. And I remember going for a second plate, and my dad looked at me and said, "Nidzin, do you really need that second helping?" Now, at that time, I didn't realize that my dad was trying to help, and he didn't mean any ignorance or pain with the comment. It's just I've always been a bigger girl. So in my mind at that time, I thought, okay, well, I'm getting it from everybody at school, and now it's coming from my dad. Now, if anybody knows, my dad is a person that I trust and admire a great deal. And since he's passed away, he's definitely taught me everything that I am, so I'm thankful for that. I remember going to my room, and I remember sitting there, and I had my closet door open, and I was just rummaging through papers, crying, and I remember finding a razor. So I was pretty well to the point where I was like, you know what, enough is enough. Nobody likes me. I don't even like me. I remember putting the razor to my wrist, and I remember saying, "I love you, Mom and Dad. I'm sorry." And I was just about to cut when a knock on the door. And I remember my mom coming in, and my back was facing her as I was facing the closet, and I threw that razor so darn quick. And she just asked, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Oh, nothing. I'm just cleaning my room." And she said, "Okay, well, I just wanted to come in and let you know how much I love you." And that's when it stopped.
Uh-huh.
So what are the odds that I went through that, and my mom just came in at random to say, "Hey, kiddo, I just want you to know how much I love you." You know?
Uh-huh.
So with all that happening, I didn't really know how to deal with it at the time. I mean, being that young and seeing such darkness and having such self-hatred, I mean, how is it that a youth or a child can even step forward when even our adults are struggling just as much, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I ended up approaching my mom and letting her know that I was depressed and I was having a tough time. So a doctor's appointment was made, and I was put on some antidepressants, which I ended up stopping because they did not make me feel good at all. I actually had more suicidal thoughts than I had previous.
Uh-huh.
With that, I had been to numerous counselors, psychologists, and the life situations just kept crashing before me. In 2010, I was hit by a drunk driver, and it literally changed everything in my life. And that was probably one of the hardest traumas I had to face, and will continue facing with a better head on my shoulders. So I remember talking to my cousin. I went out to Debden. I was talking to my cousin Stephen, and he said, "Oh, Nidzin, I need to let you know about Lori Davis." And I was like, "Okay, who's this Lori Davis?" And he explained to me that you had the educational workshops titled Reclaiming My Self-Worth, and I was like, "Yeah, I want that." And I remember talking to you on the phone, actually. We were only supposed to talk about 15, 20 minutes, and our conversation ended up being 45 minutes to an hour. And I remember you sending me the information on Reclaiming My Self-Worth. So we connected. I came out to Alberta, and I took Reclaiming My Self-Worth, and I followed that by the 40 weeks of workshops in the Core Empowerment Program. And then my husband and I actually also decided to take, I believe it was 12 weeks of educational workshops called Power Couples. And I am now becoming a facilitator with Lori to be doing the Missing Link. And that's pretty well why I do the work that I do. I can honestly say that I was an unhealthy person helping unhealthy people. I know that I'm good at my job, but now I know that I'm even better. And it's interesting because the work that I do with my kids now, knowing my value and my worth, those are things that I can instill in them. I know when I was younger, I wanted to be a surgeon. And then life situations happened to me, and there's some of those things that weren't my fault, but it is and was my responsibility to heal. I think I sat in the victim role for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there for a long time, realizing that I was doing more harm to myself than anybody else ever did. And when I have a youth approaching me saying, Nadzin, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here today. I'd have taken my life.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Like, these are the youth that I work with. Suicide calls happen often, and I'm called out. But I think because of the information that you taught me, Lori, with the workshops, it gave me the key that I was searching for the most, and that was forgiveness. And I had to forgive myself. And I had to forgive those that hurt me. So I could not allow my past to dictate my future. I want to dictate my future. So it really lit fire, and there was fire in me, but the flame definitely got brighter. And I know that I'm doing my job with the bestest abilities that I have. And honestly, I owe the biggest thanks to you for those workshops, because it saved my life. It gave me a second chance, and one that I could see, and one that I could dream for myself. I got to dream again, Lori.
Aww.
You know, I was able to see that there were things in life that I could achieve, and that a lot of things and qualities that I had were just covered by all the trauma and everything I went through. And to find all those gifts that were hidden, it has been a beautiful process getting to know myself again, my true authentic self,
mm-hmm.
and giving that child a hug and forgiving her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm
mm-hmm.
very thankful I didn't take my life, because look at where I am today. I am very successful in who I am as a person and what I'm trying to achieve and working for a better future for our youth.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I died. And I mean, at the age of 8, to see that darkness,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I didn't plan on you validating what we do here or promoting me. That wasn't the purpose, but I appreciate it. And when I share my story at the end of the show, people will understand why that was so critical for you and is so critical for me, the work that we do in the world. So thank you so very much, Nadzin, for taking time. Anything else you'd like to say?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity. And I really am quite proud of you and what you've achieved and what you've allowed me to achieve. And I just appreciate you believing in me when I couldn't.
Oh, so thank you.
I thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And maybe because I'm going to take liberties here, you do work with youth. Words of encouragement to all of our parents out there who have lost children to suicide. Anything that you'd like to say to them?
Words of encouragement to the parents.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the parents have other children, it's literally just listening to your child.
Mm-hmm.
Sincerely listening to them. It's never mind the spilt milk. What is it that's bothering your child? Communication
mm-hmm.
is the key, and they need to have that safe place. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was able to be comfortable enough to open up with my mom. So it allowed a path to my healing and little stepping stones. But, it's just listen to your kids. They have voices.
Yeah.
Remember that. And their voices, everything and anything they have to say has value. So
mm-hmm.
that would be my tidbit of information, Lori.
Well, that's pretty powerful. So thank you so much, Nadzin. And I'm going to put you on mute here, and we'll wrap up with my own story, because this topic is very near and dear to me as well. It was a hot day in August of 1984. I came home from work one day, and I discovered my husband, who was my childhood sweetheart. We'd been together for 25 years. I'd known him since I was 12. I knew the family really well, too. And I got out of my car, and he was mowing the lawn, and he wasn't mowing it the way that he normally does. He was This was a guy who was handsome and fit and usually ran behind that lawnmower. But this particular day, he was walking very slowly behind that lawnmower. And when I got over to him, he was crying. And I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "No, I'm not." And he lifted his head, and there were 4 rope burn marks on his neck where he had tried to hang himself that day while I was at work. I got him into the house and called my doctor, and we immediately got him to emergency, and then he was transferred over to a mental institution, of course, and placed on a suicide ward. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I didn't have any information. I didn't have any experience with family violence or suicide, at the very least. So he was in there about a week, and the doctors told me to come and pick him up on a Friday, which I did. And so I went to pick him up a week later. They told me that they had made an appointment for him at a psychiatric care Monday. He had some personality disorders. And I wasn't seeing any of it. I couldn't even see it because my husband didn't drink very much at all. He didn't smoke. He wasn't on drugs. He was a hard worker. Had a short fuse, though. Had a short fuse and was angry a lot. So the next weekend, I picked him up, took him home, and we had our second attempt, which was much more graphic, to try to kill himself a second time in the bathroom while I was out with our little dog. I came back, and he had slashed his throat. And I found him, and he was still alive. That would be when I would say I had an out-of-the-body experience, because I knew exactly what to do to keep him alive and safe until I called the police and an ambulance. And what took 5 minutes seemed like it took 5 hours. He was then transferred over again to the mental institution where he stayed for 2 years. The family was ripped apart. Our families were really close. But they were ripped apart because they thought I had made the wrong decisions and maybe it was my fault. And of course, the first place I went was that it was my fault. Perhaps I wasn't a good wife. I wasn't doing enough. Because we all have that in the aftermath. As Sharon said earlier, Dr. Sharon said, the shoulda, coulda, wouldas. What could I have done? What could I have said? Why didn't I see it coming? Like a train wreck this was. But I was not that well myself when I think about it. I was in my little bubble, doing my thing, not really paying attention. And the sad part of this story is, 2 years later, when he finally was released, and he was going to be living with his sister, he phoned me. He said, "Could we have a day?" I said, "Sure." So we had a day together. We went for lunch. And all he talked about were his plans. He was going to get a job and we could still be friends. We can't be married. I said, "We can't be married." Because the day that he did that to himself, the police were concerned that I was even still alive. Because in that situation, sometimes they take themselves last after they take everyone else. So anyway, he came out and I spent my day and it was a peaceful day of forgiveness and love. I said, "I'm your friend. I will always be your friend. That will never change. I will support you." And while he had been in the hospital, we amicably divorced because he knew I would never be able to trust that relationship again for safety reasons. And he didn't want that either for me. So I thought, okay, he's on his way. He's on the right road. 3 weeks later, I get a call from the police, the RCMP here in Canada, asking me if I'd seen him. And I said, "No, not in about 3 weeks. And they said, "Well, we have found his car, some personal belongings, but we've been searching for him for a week and we haven't got anything." I went, "What?" "Yes, he's missing. He had left his sisters, as far as I know, to go visit his brother, never showed up." That was in September of 1986. And no body has ever been recovered. So he has been, I don't know if he still is, on a missing persons list since 1986. So for me, there was no funeral. There was no closure. And I lived that for many years. As a matter of fact, I was in such denial about my situation when people would ask me, are you married? I'd say, no, I'm a widow. Oh, I'm sorry. How did he pass? And I would say, well, you know, he was in a really bad car accident. I told people that for 7 years. Can you believe it? And it was doubled by another tragedy in my family at the very same time of the year, the same year, 1984, on the 6th of December, my little niece, Erin, Margaret Anthony, stepped off the school bus and was killed by the school bus driver driving the bus. So by Christmas, we had two members of our family missing around the Christmas tree, the two younger members of our family. So what does it take to survive? Well, a very big seed got planted at that time because, as I said earlier, I was pretty unhealthy myself emotionally, and I was all about the good look thing. Everything had to be perfect. I had to look perfect. The house had to be perfect. My work had to be perfect. I was all tied up in that. And that's because I wasn't very well, trying to cover up my shame. And so I didn't know how to step forward, but I just took one day at a time. And then I realized, wow, if my husband had had a place to go where he could have opened up and talked about his childhood, because he lost his dad when he was 11, and he never recovered from that. He never got any professional care. He was just lost in that and blamed himself, wouldn't let himself off the hook for things he had said or done in the home. He was considered a troubled child. He got a lot of labels. A lot of bad things were said to him. So just like Ned Zen, after a while, when we don't believe we have any value and that nobody actually cares if we're here or not, and those words were said to him as a child, I know that for a fact. He was carrying a lot of burdens that I didn't know anything about. And so that was the great seed that was planted many years ago for the work that we do today, the work that I do today. Because sometimes all we really need is somebody to talk to. And the problem is we don't want to talk about it. I have so many clients who say, I'd love to come and see you, but I don't want to go there. Well, we need to go there, especially around this situation of suicide. I was doing a presentation at a conference about 2 years ago, and I was talking, it was suicide prevention. I don't even like that word anymore, suicide prevention. I prefer, let's show our children how to stay alive. Let's show them that there's something to stay alive for. And at the conference, I had my statistics up there. And at the time, I said the youngest known case to date has been children aged 9 and up. And holy moly, during the break, I had this lady come up to me and say, Lori, I don't mean to correct you in any way, but in our community in the Northwest Territories, we had a little girl, 5, hang herself. So that's why my passion and drive, it's not about suicide prevention workshops. It's not about suicide prevention hotlines. It's not about suicide prevention anything. It's about the flip side. And that is supporting, as Ned Zen said, listening and showing our children why they need to stay alive. And the key component to that is to love ourselves and teaching our children how to love themselves. Because if I love myself, I'm not going to do anything to hurt myself. It's when I don't love myself and I don't think I'm important and I don't think I have value. And that doesn't come from buying them stuff. It doesn't come from there. It's about building those inside core values that we need to have in order to feel worthy. So I have my own story, and all of my guests today have all different stories. So I'm trusting that in some piece of this broadcast, even if you've only picked up on one small thing that you could do to change things, it could save a life. I'm Lori Davis. You've been listening to The Lori Davis Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Our show is posted, will be posted, on my Facebook page, The Lori Davis Show Facebook page. Please share it. It could save a life. And I thank you for listening and supporting the show. Tomorrow, we have an Indigenous team of very ambitious young entrepreneurs who are changing the financial future and helping me people move from poverty to prosperity by providing financial education. So make sure you listen in or catch that show. That's tomorrow here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Lori Davis. Bye for now.